The meeting of the Transportation Committee to order. We do have a quorum. I have Senator Pascavant, Senator Meyer, and myself, Senator Kukesh. It is 3 minutes after 1 o'clock, and we have before us House Bill 114. It's an act relating to availability of state transportation facilities and state-owned or state-operated transportation modes for delivering compassionate aid. The sponsor of the legislation is here, Representative Ramos, and I ask you to identify yourself for the record and your affiliation, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Jay Ramos, Representative District 10. With me is Jane Pearson, I've worked with for 5 years, and many of you know. And I'm glad to be before you. Senator, I find myself conflicted. On one hand, I want to offer a short narrative behind House Bill 114. And on the other hand, I know that here in the Senate, there's just not a lot of dialogue or talking. So I think I'll try and find a middle way of giving you a very truncated narrative.
Senator, and that was it?
No, yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We like to be efficient.
Yeah, well done. Senator, I have a close family friend. My Uncle Bill is a plumber in North Pole, and when I was coming down for the first day of session last year, his church, Zion Lutheran, in responding to that email that originated in Ammonic, his church youth group raised 3,000 pounds of food. And he said, "Nephew," and he's a plumber, so he's very aggressive in his tones. "Hi, Senator." He said, "Nephew, you go down there and you figure out how to get this 3,000 pounds of food out to Western Alaska, because transportation remains very challenged, as you know, Senator, from some of the areas that you represent." And I struggled from the moment that I got down here and trying to get a way to access state transportation assets. And it was difficult. And when we traced it back, it had to do with the frequency with which economic declarations of disasters were declared by a previous governor, and then the response that the legislature took. And finally, it was settled that in order for an economic declaration of disaster to be called, it had to take people below the federal poverty line. And so I conferred with one of your colleagues, Senator Olson, and one thing led to another and to another. And Senator, our office, with help from people throughout this building, we created a supply chain out of nothing. We raised 40,000 pounds of food and $25,000 in cash. Some of that from people here in this building at charitable events and other individuals. And sadly, Senator, much of the money had to be allocated to transportation in rural Alaska while transportation assets for the state sat idle. And there was there's politics and everything. And so rather than to look back on some of the circumstances that were the genesis of that politics, I would rather focus on going forward positively and work on coming up with a path that will allow this governor and future governors to be able to find a course of action that doesn't necessarily require a declaration of emergency. In the House Judiciary Committee, we've been dealing with the definition of obscenity. And as is often the case, you may not be able to define it, but you know it when you see it. And I think the same is true for Alaskans that are in need of aid. Sometimes it's a difficult thing to define specifically, but we know it when we see it. And Alaskans are very generous, but our ability sometimes to coordinate the generosity and the giving and the tithing spirit of Alaskans and to co-mingle that sometimes with the less agile nature of government is something that all of us assembled in this room spend a great deal of our daytime working hours trying to smooth. And so that's what House Bill 114 does. It's a compassionate aid bill that gives the governor the opportunity when a need arises in the state and a group recognizes that and raises food or water or medicine or clothing or some need, and rather than a lot of the money being raised going toward the cost of transportation, If the governor so deems it, then he can direct state transportation assets to move that material to the affected area.
Thank you. Did your aide want to make any comments? Do you want to make any comments? Identify
Senator
yourself,
Kukesh,
please, for the record.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, and I think that Representative Rammers presented what needs to be presented on this bill.
Okay, good. Questions from... let me first note for the record that we have been joined by Senator Davis, Senator Menard. Thank you very much for being here. Any questions from members of the Senate Transportation Committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer?
I can't resist. Okay. I have to pick on my old housemate here.
Could you just move...
Sure.
I have to reflect back here on my finance days and look at the fiscal note. It just seems like, how did you get it through all these committees, especially House Finance, without at least an indeterminate fiscal note? Because if you're going to use state transportation assets to get the supplies out to these areas, isn't there a cost of some sort? I know you don't know what the cost would be, but there should be a cost. So I would think it'd be indeterminate.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. You ask better questions now that you're in the other body than you did when you were in the
House. Still not going to help move your bill any, Representing Rammers. It's nice though that you're being obsequious. That's good.
Yes, sir. To be specific, if I may read from the
yes.
transcript from the present Deputy Commissioner of Military and Veteran Affairs, McHugh, who's in the room. At the time, in his capacity as Director of Communications, answered that the language gives the DMVA emphasis and directions on how to proceed when the department responds to emergencies. He explained that the change would not impact the DMVA's operating budget. He offered that the Disaster Relief Fund is funded by the legislature. When the fund reaches a certain threshold cost, which he said he believes is between $500,000 and $1 million, depending on the situation, the DMVA requests additional funds to accomplish the mission and rescue Alaskans. And then a quote in here from him says, "To use all available resources is encompassed in the Disaster Relief Fund." So, Senator, I don't have a more specific answer than that, but I believe that we're just on standby.
We do have someone from the administration here who will speak to that.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, let's go ahead and ask other questions.
Thank you. Pleasure to have you here, and I think that the bill is well-meaning, and my only focus is why is there a gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct reference in here? In other words, if somebody's out there and they run somebody down with a motor vehicle, obviously it's a state's policy that there be insurance in place. This would say that if you run somebody over with a motor vehicle, there's no responsibility.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, your colleague, Senator Meyer, can attest to how helpful my colleague, Representative Gruenberg, can be when he assists in developing legislation. And this was came in and out of the bill and ultimately was offered as an amendment on the floor by Minority Leader Kurtula. And we graciously accepted, and as a layperson, I don't really remember why that remedied a situation, because I share your point of view, but we decided that it was best to move this bill on its way.
If I may,
yes,
in other words, I noticed that I believe that the improvement was from outright immunity, and I certainly understand that from a management level, that there shouldn't be liability if someone says we're going to get a charitable product out to a village. That I think is an insulated decision. But if somebody on the ground runs somebody over with a motor vehicle and it has insurance, why wouldn't that insurance be responsible? And it's it really is a basic fundamental question as to which state policy is more pressing, the state's motor vehicle policy that mandates coverage for exactly that type of an act, or the state's policy to distribute emergency aid, which I fully support. I want to make sure that you understand that I fully support this, but that's the policy issues that I see there.
Through the chair, Senator Pascarino, if Jane could field this one, she understands the issue better.
Senator Pascarino, through the chair, we kind of went round and round about this one. Usually the state language is consistent with AS 2620-140, and it defines what the state is liable for. This was one on the floor that the representative who offered it really thought that there should be a liability threshold for gross negligence and for things that were done outside of the normal course of business, and that there should be some liability for the state. If in the course of helping people that there was an act that was grossly negligent. I mean, I guess I can explain how we got there.
I understand that it's outside the ordinary and usual scope of the activity, if I may, Mr. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, in other words, it's outside the scope of their ordinary and usual activity, but to some extent that's what governments are best able to do, is to respond in times of emergency. And that decision to respond, I think, should be an immune decision. But when you carry out that operation, you know, or where you carry out that decision that we are going to declare an emergency, we are going to respond to an emergency, and we are going to then implement a plan, when the, so to speak, the boots on the ground run somebody over, that's different than the decision whether we're going to declare an emergency and respond to an emergency. And that's the very precise, I guess, point of separation where I agree with immunity, complete immunity applies to the determination as to whether you declare an emergency, whether you respond to a specific emergency over some other emergency. But once you make the decision to respond to a particular emergency in a particular way, and then you get out there and then somebody runs them over with a car, do we impose on that one person that gets run over, just say, so sorry, the state doesn't care?
Through the chair, in fact, Senator Pascarino, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. But we worked it through the floor, and legislation is often compromised, and so this was a compromise that we accepted on the House floor to you know, see the legislation move, because it was an issue for several of the attorneys that we have that are in the minority on the House floor, and it was an accommodation specifically to Representative Gruenberg and to Representative, to Minority Leader Curtula. But in fact, it's hard for me to argue for a portion of this bill that, frankly, I thought was superfluous to the legislation as well. And I'll leave that in your capable hands, whether you want to accommodate the wishes of some of the lawyers in my body, or whether you want to try and amend it back to the way we had the bill before it left the House floor.
Well, a couple of quick questions really quick. I appreciate that the governor still plays a role, but I notice you have the word may in here. Tell me why you have the word may if the governor still has the option of saying that he's not going to help for any particular reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's an excellent question. I think may is the appropriate word. Transportation costs to rural Alaska are remarkably expensive. And I think that if it was if the word was shall, I think that we would put the executive branch and its transportation assets in a very awkward position. That what if you had a group of Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts that went out and raised blankets and wanted to move them to a rural community that they were doing a service project for, that may or may not have the need at the time, or a greater disaster, where the National Guard was already responding, where an appropriate disaster declaration had been made. I think that the word shall would actually encumber the governor unnecessarily and its transportation assets, and it may is indicative that the governor should have an appropriate judgment call to make.
So you leave the governor with a judgment call yet, and that's why you wanted to have the main. Well, that makes some sense to me.
And Mr. Chairman, we were hamstrung last year because what we heard, and it was very frustrating to me in a House caucus meeting, was that the staff to the governor said, we can't move food out there because it's against the law. And I said, there happens to be a higher moral code than the blue statute book, and we need to get food out there. And it was at that point that, having created this supply chain, that we made the decision to allocate quite a bit of the $25,000 that could have bought more food, and we used it instead for the transportation that wasn't otherwise donated. And we had some extraordinarily generous donations of transportation from Carlisle, from Alaska Airlines, from some smaller commuter carriers. But often the cost of the food per pound was as much or nearly as much as the food itself, which is, for those of us that have visited rural Alaska or are sensitive to the cost of food out there, is no surprise that it does. I mean, we weren't moving king crab and prawns and fillets out there, Chairman, as you know. We were moving basic staples out there. And we airlifted, as it was, 40,000 pounds of food to 11 different villages. And then we were delighted that Pastor Franklin Graham and the previous governor and Samaritan's Purse followed our lead and brought another 44,000 pounds of food out to Western Alaska, and not only fed hungry people, but also were able to cover some of that divide that sometimes, as much as we try and fight it, comes up between urban and rural Alaska. And we were able to demonstrate some compassion, I think, and be able to show interest to folks and bring some comfort.
How did the former governor move her 44,000 pounds out?
I believe that Franklin Graham had his own airplane, I think. And when we used into either volunteer transportation other than when I begged the Commissioner of Public Safety for two small airplanes, when I was able to move food out to maybe it was to Bethel, and then I was able to use two DPS, small DPS vehicles to make a last leg of food, and then after that I wasn't able to get any state transportation, and it was frustrating. But I'm trying to look forward, Mr. Chairman, and not backward, because it's a looking backward, it doesn't serve a purpose for any of us or for this piece of legislation. This is about going forward in a positive direction and curing a deficiency that was in the statute book. And as Legislative Director Jerry Gallagher said last year, putting another tool in the toolbox for the governor, and that's the way I prefer to perceive this.
Very good. And the only reason we're asking questions about the past is because this is new to us.
Yes, sir.
The bill is new to us. It's spent some time in the House, but we haven't had a chance to do it. Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator,
I just have one question following it up, and it addresses the federal government declaration of an emergency and the state government declaration of emergency. And I believe that if the federal government declares an emergency and responds, that they don't have the requested level of immunity that was inserted on your side of this body. And because I see in your original bill you did not have that. You just wanted to say we want to have the state take action, and get it and accomplish this most worthy of all purposes that a government can do.
Absolutely.
And so you wouldn't mind if we put it more back to what you originally intended?
Through the chair, Senator Pasfin, fundamentally I believe that we are judged by the way we take care of the weakest amongst us. And last year there was a lot of hardship in Western Alaska, and I work closely with my food bank, Fairbanks, and I'm proud to tell you that I've raised 1 million pounds of food over the last dozen years for my food bank with the help of a lot of people in Fairbanks. It was hard. It was tough out there. Senator Olson took me out there, and I asked Senator Olson, who I have great respect for, and I said, "Are people hungry out there?" And as you know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson is, unlike me, he enjoys an economy of words. And he responded, and he said, some are. And for those of us, and as I look around your committee table, perhaps with the exception of you, Mr. Chairman, we live in urban communities that have significant safety nets. And we have people that fall through the safety nets. But as you go to rural Alaska and as you go to subsistence Alaska, if there is high fuel, $11 a gallon fuel for kilowatts and for diesel, if there is a bad season for subsistence, a whole community can crash through a safety net out in western Alaska. Furthermore, we know how important it is to have leadership at a committee level or the leader of the Senate or the leader of the House. You know, we work within organizations that have leadership. And you can have two communities out in western Alaska and two different mayors, and it's like two shoe stores. One's a great mayor and one's an average mayor. And you can present them with the same situational crisis and the same resources, and one of them can take their community through that crisis pretty good shape. And the other one can just wreck the whole ship on the shore. And to answer your question, Senator, I may okay with that, but it will require then a concurrence vote over on my body, and it would be preferable to me to not have that issue with Representative Gruenberg and Representative Kurtula. So I'm very comfortable with it, but it would be more accommodating, I think, for the success of House Bill 114 finding its way into the governor's toolbox to leave the bill in its present condition and allow this to go forward and not create a concurrence conflict for me on the House floor, to be quite honest.
Senator Menard? Thank you. Questions? Members of the committee? No? Do you have any more you want to add?
It's been a privilege to come before
and
you.
And if you want to just take a seat in the back, we'll have the administration come forward and give us some comments. Thank you for being here today. Your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. My name is McHugh Pierre. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee. First and foremost, I'm here also with Mike Nave from Department of Law. He should be on teleconference.
He is on teleconference, and he's available to answer questions.
If you guys have any questions, Mr. Chairman, about the legality or any of the statements that I make or the claims, he's certainly here to clarify that. But I'd like to start by saying I support Representative Rammers. The sponsor of this bill has very good intentions, and I just wanted to add some clarification to this. The administration is not opposed to this passing. The language, the way it's written, is important. Shall needs to be in here because we're talking about giving the keys of state equipment to a nonprofit. If shall is not in here, how else do we distinguish between who is an acceptable nonprofit and who is not? Mr. Chairman, you yourself could make a nonprofit right now, or I could make a nonprofit and say, I need your vehicle. So we need to have the ability to make sure we investigate and have due diligence to clear nonprofits to use equipment if that is the case. I know, Mr. Chairman, that one of your members asked a question about the legality and immunity. This bill addresses pre-disaster declaration issues. So that's when the immunity becomes a question. When we declare a disaster, this bill would not be in effect, because in a disaster, you have carte blanche to take care of business at the state level, and then when it becomes a presidential disaster at a federal level. So we have a wide range. This is addressing when a state department, such as DOT or DMVA or DPS, gives a plane or a boat or a car to somebody. It's not the state's responsibility then when that person wrecks the car. It is the person and the person's nonprofit organization. It's their responsibility. And that goes back to the word shall. It's important that we do the responsible clearing to make sure that the nonprofit is properly insured, that they are covered, to where in case they do wreck the car and hurt somebody, that the nonprofit can take care of that person that they injured. So I just wanted to make sure that I clarified that. And also, Mr. Chairman, legality of response. Unfortunately, we had a situation last year, and the sponsor of this bill has a huge heart for service, and he really stepped up and led people to respond to that situation. And it was found that there could have been more action taken. The governor does have the power to use state equipment for virtually anything, pre-disaster or post-disaster. It's just a matter of how we pay for it. And so, to make sure everyone's clear, a National Guard asset is not necessarily a state asset, because we do have federal equipment that is controlled by federal rules and regulations, such as the Economy Act and the Stafford Act. So state equipment in that realm is narrowed. But we certainly we support Representative Rammers and his intentions, and we'd like to make sure that if you have any questions, that we can answer that. And we hope that this is another tool in the governor's tool chest, that as we sit today, there's been a lot of proactive effort to address need in rural areas. And we certainly appreciate the time to be before the committee, Mr. Chairman.
On the question of May and Shell, does the administration still support it if it went forward with May?
I apologize. I meant to say May. Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for clarifying. May is appropriate instead of shall. If we may have the choice, you're directing us, yes. Thank you. It's certainly a Freudian slip there, Mr. Chairman. I don't want the word shall.
Okay, good. That clarifies it for us. And Senator Pascua.
I understand Mike Nave is available.
Yes, he is. He's online, on off-net. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I know Mr. Nave, so I would like to...
Yes, absolutely.
Whenever it's appropriate. So.
Why don't you just go ahead and sit there, and let's go ahead and ask the question. Mr. Nave, are you available online?
I am, if the microphone's working.
It is, and you're coming in really nice and clear. So we do have a question from Senator Pascua.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Senator Pascua.
You know, the state of Alaska has its general planning operational distinctions, you know, set forth in statute. And the questions that I had proposed deal with why should, if the state declares an emergency and somebody gets run over on the ground, why should that one singular person bear the misery of their injuries if it's caused by somebody's fault? Why shouldn't we just stick with Alaska's general operational planning distinction?
Through the chair, Senator Pascua, I think that is a good question. And not to reprise what was discussed in the slightly different way that you asked it last time, but the question might be, if I understand it correctly, the question might be just slightly restated and more made more specific. If the committee were to look at, for example, AS 26.23 and provisions of that chapter, specifically 26.23.020, subsection little c, and later on 26.23.020, subsection little g, it supports what Mr. Pierre said a minute ago about the governor already having the authority to commit state resources, specifically vehicles, to a disaster response. The potential argument or problem that you, Senator Pascan, point out is if that authority with a disaster declaration, if that authority exists on behalf of the governor already, then how does the new grant, purported grant of immunity, fit into the already existing statutory immunity network that's set up in 26, 23, and various sections of that statute? And the answer is probably we don't exactly know yet, and it would lead to it could lead to arguments by various litigants. For example, in your example, if there's a, God forbid, if there's an accident and people get hurt or killed, it could lead to that argument and that question being put right in front of a state court judge. the Department of Law is somewhat concerned that that immunity grant might be less broad and less strong than existing immunity grants that are already in other statutes, specifically that it could lead to a new immunity standard that isn't summary judgment capable, if you will. And that's probably a longer answer than you wanted for your question, but I'll be glad to break it down in any pieces you might like.
Thank you, and I've grabbed the statute books that are in the courtroom, and so I guess that even raises another level of questions that we have. If I understand what you're saying, then, is that we already have a statutory structure that deals with governor-declared disaster emergencies that, in part, address this. Is that the first?
That's certainly a fair and better restatement of what I just said. That's right.
Okay. And then the second question is within that existing, and if I read this, this goes back to 1977, last amended in 04, what is the standard for liability, assuming that there's a governor-declared disaster or emergency under 2623020?
That is, in fact, the question. There, are you asking me to cite to the specific statutory standards in it?
I'm trying to figure out if there was there a separate or a distinct standard for liability separate from the state's general planning operational tests that's, I think, included in Title 45.
If or I'm whatever Mr. the... Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, this is McHugh Pierre, a DMVA Deputy Commissioner. Through the Chair, Senator Pascavan, I think the clarification here is during a declared disaster, only a state employee would be operating the vehicle. So then this actually would take House Bill 114, as it stands, would take it and move into a separate category that is not yet defined that says what happens when a state vehicle is being operated by someone who is not a state employee but a nonprofit employee, how do we treat that situation? And so that's why the section of immunity is brought into this. So the state isn't held responsible for the actions pre-disaster because there is no disaster declaration when we would use this. How do we make sure that the state isn't on the hook for something that a nonprofit or some other acceptable organization should be on the hook because one of their employees took the action?
I think, is it, Mr. Nave, fair to say that as currently written, it's very confusing in reference to other state statutes?
Without expressing any opinion on the wisdom or intent of the statute, the interplay between existing sections, 2623, specifically 2623210, 2623140, and the present bill, the interplay between those sections and Chapter 2623 in general and the immunity grant in this bill, the answer is yes. The interplay would be confusing.
Okay.
And I don't mean to express any derogation of the bill or its intentions. I point out that how these two fit together in the case of litigation over a specific accident, we've got to remember that if this immunity grant comes up, it's going to be in a specific factual context. Someone will have been hurt or allegedly hurt, let's say, in a specific incident out there in the woods somewhere. And in that accident, there will be questions about whether potential defendants A, B, C, D, and E should be held liable. And how the two statutes fit together will matter. It will matter because it will have specific impact on those individual defendants and their potential liability. So Department of Law has some can see possible arguments coming in a later lawsuit that lead us to believe there could be confusion on who is granted immunity and who is not. Again, that's a longer answer than the word yes, but that's the intention.
Yes, Mr. Nave, if I could, Alaska has pure apportionment under AS 09.17.080. So if the only function that the state was providing was a vehicle, and there was nothing unreasonable about the providing of the vehicle, then there would be no allocation of fault under existing law to the state. Then it would solely be on the nonprofit driver. Is that, am I understanding Mr. Pierre correctly in that regard?
That may, this through the chair, Senator Pascan, that may well be the intention or an intention behind the drafting of this statute. But I'll posit just a slightly different factual scenario. Let's say that the plaintiff's claim was an aircraft belonging to the state was turned over by well-meaning state officials to some nonprofit air crew that had no business flying it, and that the act of making the decision to turn over that state vehicle, well-intended though it might be, was very negligent. Well, the first place that litigants and a judge might look, depending again on the factual circumstances, the first place they might look is the very detailed existing statutes that cover what to do in the case of a disaster declaration. Now, if the factual scenario is that there has been no disaster declaration by the governor, but the governor and or agencies have nonetheless turned over this airplane meaning well, but to people that they shouldn't have, you might get two different answers. In one case, with a disaster declaration, there might have been tort immunity for certain state decisions and officials, and in the other case, we don't know, maybe not.
Let me get back to the case here, so specific. Would the state in fact turn over an airplane or a vehicle to anybody who is not authorized to drive it? I don't think that would happen.
Mr. Chairman,
that's why. You can convince me otherwise.
No, sir, Mr. Chairman, I will not. This is McHugh Pierre for the record. And that's why the word may is so critical in this bill. So we have the ability to discern from someone who is competent and someone who is not. And that way, when we are faced with a situation, we will be in the right position of making a sound judgment call, Mr. Chairman.
I just don't see the state turning an airplane over to anybody who is not a state employee. Because every vehicle in the state probably has a designated driver or a designated pilot. Isn't that the case?
Yes, sir. We have it's not necessarily always to the person, Mr. Chairman, but it is a broad swath. These people are allowed to use the vehicle. Yes. Yeah.
But they're state employees.
Yes, sir.
State vehicles, state airplanes, everything else.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I think that's what the state has always done. Representative Rammers, you seem really willing to wanting to come up here to say something, so I'll let you have the floor here for a minute.
Mr. Chairman, Representative J. Rammers, it wasn't our intention for nonprofits to operate state assets. I think it would be possible for members of nonprofit organizations to participate in loading airplanes, unloading airplanes, and it's hard for me to argue for this portion of the bill because, as you pointed out, Senator Pascan, my version of the bill did not include that provision, and I'm only interested in shepherding this piece of legislation through both bodies. But I think that the scope of liability that we talked about on the House really went to volunteers of, say, a church group that would be loading a state van. And should there be an accident from the state driver driving a state van who ran over a nonprofit volunteer worker, either in the affected area or in the area where the charitable goods were being loaded onto a state vehicle, seemed to be what we got wrapped around last year. And I found the provision superfluous to the piece of legislation, and you heard my narrative. So we don't anticipate church group leaders driving state or flying state airplanes or marine craft. Just to set you at ease, Mr. Chairman, we thank Mr. Nave, we thank McHugh for allowing us to offer this clarification. Thank you.
Yeah, because I've driven sailing boats, gill netters all around Southeast Alaska. I'm sure they wouldn't let me at the wheel at Alaska Marine Ferry. I'm sure they wouldn't.
Mr. Chairman, it certainly depends. And Representative Rammers, the sponsor, has a very good idea here, and he wants to expand the toolbox, and we support the expansion of the toolbox, and we certainly urge you to pass this and allow the option to be on the table.
Thank you. Thank appreciate you, Mr. the Chairman. Clarification. Sure. Questions? And Senator Pascal, you get your question answered, or would you like to expand?
I believe it is. And, you know, my concern is that we have a tendency to lose sight of the innocent person that might be injured as a result of the response. And I just wonder if the state's policy should be, so what? You know, even though you were the innocent person injured as a result of someone's fault, that the state looks at them and say, well, we're in a disaster. We don't care. We just walked all over the innocent. That's a major policy choice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pascal, that will not happen.
We better get rid of subsection B.
I hope that will never happen.
Your hope conflicts with language. That's my statement.
We ought to put, yeah, okay, that's great. Questions from members of the committee? Do you have more to add?
No, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I think you were going to explain the fiscal note.
Certainly. I apologize. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the fiscal note really is zero because it should reflect that. This is a what-if scenario, and we have put a policy forward to where we should not provide indeterminate fiscal notes. We need to give the best information possible. And as this stands, we could spend zero money until there's a unique anomaly, statistical outlier, if you will, that allows us to expend funds. And when that happens, it should not be something that we cannot absorb as a state agency, speaking for myself, not speaking for other state agencies. But otherwise, if we can't, we have the opportunity to come before your body and ask for a supplemental to take care of that extraordinary expense. So I see this really as a zero fiscal note until, because we don't know the extent that we need to use this. What happens if you need to drive a Ford Explorer six-cylinder 30 miles? It's very difficult to find out, okay, well, is that a necessary recordable cost? And how far do we go, and how far do we take the what if?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Meyer, questions, comments?
Well, just a comment. I appreciate you being here because you're here for Senate Bill 216 and certainly educated us greatly, I would say, and about our hope that we can move forward with the ceiling being at $14,950 instead of the $5,000. So, again, this is the second time you've certainly given us information on disasters and how we have to operate. So, thank you.
So your final word would be that the governor would support this, the administration supports this, it should go forward. You're happy with May. The indeterminate fiscal note would be probably questioned in the Finance Committee, which is where it goes next. Mm-hmm. But you're willing to address that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Sure. Representative Ramos, do you have any more you want to add? Okay, with that, I'll appreciate you. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on this particular bill? Did you have another question?
I just wanted to make note to the representatives, Ramos's Good Samaritan work, and I appreciate it very much as someone that's been nonprofits pretty most of my life.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? Is there anybody else online? Anybody else online? With that, I'm going to close public testimony. What is the wish of the committee? I don't have any objection as the chairman to moving this out.
You know, I don't have a problem in moving this bill out. I have a problem with subsection B, and I think at the very minimum it should be discussed. And, you know, I applaud Representative Ramirez's, there was a guy that didn't let the lack of a good law get in the way of accomplishing what needed to be accomplished. And Representative Ramirez did that, and he made the whole state of Alaska look great, I think. And so I think that we need to put a law in place so that there aren't barriers to accomplishing the magnitude of the good that Representative Ramirez accomplished at that time. But, you know, given from what I've heard from Mr. Ney, from Mr. Pierre, I think at best we have a confusing, misapplied subsection B, and so that's my concern. And to the extent, I guess I would make a motion to remove subsection B from House Bill, or CS for House Bill 114. I think it's just unnecessary to accomplishing the good that needs to be accomplished.
Okay, we can have the discussion. Anybody else? Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, before we take up that conceptual amendment, does this go to judiciary? I mean, because that is
finance.
Because that issue, I think that, and I rightly agree, and knowing the cast of characters on the other side that made that amendment, that perhaps it does need to be looked at. But it almost seems like it's separate from what we're trying to do with the bill. It's almost a legal question, and I guess I'd prefer that the judiciary looked at it. But if it's not going to judiciary, then I think we should.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman. The only thing I see on this is going to finance from here. Is that your understanding of the bill? It's going to go from here to finance, yeah. Did you have a comment you'd like to make?
Senator Kukesh, for the record, I think maybe I can clear
up. Your name, please.
My name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Rammers.
Thank you.
And I think maybe I can clear up a little bit of the confusion. Last year when we were dealing with this bill, and I was dealing with Mike Mitchell at the Department of Law, and what he asked for, he said, that he sees no problems with the overall concept. However, torts arising from gross negligence or reckless or intentional misconduct is a concern, not because it's not contained under AS 2620-140, which would be the state's liability in disaster, which was where this would fall if this B section were not included. And his point was that if B were included, the state would be able to get past any claim with summary judgment. So really, this does give more liability to an individual who was hurt, and that was the intent of the amendment, so that the state was not able to roll over and claim immunity if somebody was hurt under circumstances that were not generally within the scope of average business.
Mr. Nave, are you still online?
Still here.
Yes, please. See the discussion we're having. What can you do to help us? What can you say that would help us alleviate some of our concerns about whether or not we should have this in or not have it in?
Again, that policy decision about the wisdom or not of putting in a particular immunity section, of course, that's not my call. But I can foresee if this statute were enacted with Section B, that because it's new, because it's outside the existing scope of disaster statutes, which are much, much longer and more detailed, there would very quickly, in the case of individual accidents, there would very quickly be a question of who gets immunity and who doesn't. And in a one-sentence nutshell, the chances of state employees and officers obtaining summary judgment would go down. And as the lady who just testified, I think it was Ms. Pearson, points out, it is the intent to increase potential liability on behalf of the state that gives Department of Law some pause. That Section B is intended and reads as if it is intended to increase potential state liability in lawsuits over what exists now in the other sections that pertain to disasters.
Mr. Nave, going back to 2620-140, in subsection A, I see that is only applicable to injury, quote, sustained by any person appointed or acting as a civilian defense worker. So if the volunteer gets hurt, too bad. Is that the result of that? Am I reading that correctly?
Again, Senator Pascan, could you repeat the number of the section you were looking at?
2620-140A. In other words, I think we're engaging in a law of unintended consequences here, but maybe not. I'm worried and I'm looking at subsection A, and it, the first one says that the state is not liable for injury, quote, sustained by any person appointed or acting as a civilian defense worker. And then my next question would be under B, the standard that I see there that says that the state is not liable if they are, quote, reasonably attempting to comply with this chapter. So then that's a ordinary negligence standard, or it appears to me.
You're on, I'm sorry, Senator Pascon, you're on 26.21.40, you said?
20.140, yeah, it's at page 335 of the 2008 edition.
All right, got it in front of me. Now, again, the sub letter, please, that you're looking at?
A is the first one where it says the state is not liable for injury, quote, sustained by any person appointed or acting as a civilian defense worker.
And in contrast, House Bill 114, Section B, purports to grant a broader immunity to a bigger class of people, but on a narrower substantive basis, which that is one of the shortest ways that I can boil down how Department of Law looks at this possibly raising conflicts in one lawsuit and one accident about which one should apply to whom. The interplay between these two attempted or statutory grants of immunity or limitations on state immunity, the interplay between those two is almost certain to raise arguments. And in a litigation case, let's say, again, we hope not, but in a litigation case arising out of disaster response, one of the first arguments might very well be which one of these statutes applies. And it could have different answers with some unintended consequences, as you point out, for different people in the same accident or literally in the same boat. There was one other point that I'd like to address very, very briefly earlier about the statute or the bill, rather, and its language not applying to any use of state vehicles or state aircraft by persons other than state employees. And if that's the intention, then that's fine and understood. The language reads just slightly differently in Section A, but that's not the question that you're asking right now.
If I could just go to B as of 140, Mr. Chair, is that a reasonableness standard for liability with respect to death or injury?
I think that's a fair summary.
So would the conclusion then be that subsection B of House Bill 114 would expose the innocent person injured to non-recovery for their injuries, even if the state were unreasonable?
Again, I'm sorry to put an asterisk next to your question, but it really would depend on the circumstances. The question is how would a judge apply or not apply Section B if enacted into law to a particular accident? That's pretty hard to predict with specificity. But that said, it is a different standard, and the standard is a higher bar, meaning, as you pointed out, gross misconduct, basically. That Section B standard is different than what is in the existing statutes. And again, not to be a broken record, but the interplay between those two statutes is what has me a little bit concerned about how the statutes will work together in a particular lawsuit later. because that is where these statutes, the rubber meets the road. That's how they're applied.
Thank you.
So do you maintain your motion?
As I understand what Mr. Nave just said is that the subsection B creates a higher bar for the innocent to overcome in order to be compensated for the negligence of the state. And you know, that's what I heard. I don't know if everyone heard it the same.
Let me do two things here, because I want to give the sponsor a chance to work this out. So I'm going to hold this bill. I'm going to ask the sponsor to work with Senator Pascal and with the Attorney General, or the Department of Law, Department of Law, to see if we could resolve this to a point where we can pass this out of here. In the meantime, I'll go talk to the Speaker to see if we can get a judiciary referral for this.
That would be most appropriate as well.
Yeah, because rather than just go to finance, we can go to judiciary. They can spend the time needed to discuss the liability or no liability or the higher standard and have that discussion there. I don't want to pass an amendment right now that we really don't have a handle on or a grasp on that we can explain to the next committee without having some discussion on it. So I'm going to hold a bill unless there's an objection. Ask a sponsor to work with the Department of Law and with Senator Pascal, and I'll also go to the Speaker to ask for a referral to judiciary for this if we can't resolve this for this committee. Is that satisfactory?
Absolutely, and I think that everyone on this committee is in agreement that the work that needs to be done, you know, we need to commend Representative Ramirez for his personal efforts, and I think that a law change is necessary, and I think we're all in favor of that. It's just, I don't want to hurt the innocent.
And at the same time, I don't want to hold this bill up if that language will work. But we have to have the discussion. So that's what we're going to do. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned. Thank you.